Thanks for tuning into Journey. Everyone is welcome at the table. We are a community being shaped by Jesus, experiencing and practicing humility, curiosity, belonging, and generosity. We hope to be a people who embrace the way of Jesus by listening first, speaking second, loving freely, and giving generously.
So, as we head into this series, we're trying to marry these two ideas of spiritual formation, how our spiritual life is connected to our physical life and is connected to our minds and our mental health. And so as we do that, we're trying to unpack different segments of our immaterial self each week. Last week, Susie was in heart, and she talked primarily about emotions. And we realize that what we're doing is a big undertaking, and that we can only take small segments of this, swaths of it. We can't drill into it over a period of months and parse out all the intricacies of each of these. But we do realize that they're all intertwined, and they're all related to one another. Our heart, our mind, our soul, and our strength, our bodies, are all one together, but yet we can talk about them individually and get a little more nuanced as we do that. And today we're going to talk about soul. Last week, Susie again talked about heart. And the difference between heart and soul that we're delineating is the heart houses the emotions. So she talked a lot about emotion. She talked about how we live out of that space. This week, the soul is more about identity, who we are at our core, and our very being. So there's a little difference. We get that they overlap, but this is our way of trying to parse out how to do spiritual formation in that immaterial space as it relates to each of these different areas. So I hope that brings a little bit of clarity. If it doesn't, ask us a question. I can bring more clarity to it, and I don't want to belabor that point. But we're going to read from Mark chapter 12 and hopefully go from there. Mark chapter 12, verse 28 through 34. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked him, "Of all the commandments, which is the most important?" And so Jesus is boiling down the law, the commandments, and he says this: "The most important one," answered Jesus, "is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this: Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." "Well said, teacher," the man replied, which I think is so funny that he compliments Jesus. "You are right in saying that God is one and there is no other but him. To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices." When Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, "You're not far from the kingdom of God." And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions. So as we look at these verses and we wrestle with this idea of what does it mean to love God, and what does it mean to love God with our whole being? And what does it mean that he's kind of giving us not just to love God, but the result of loving God? The natural indication is that you are loving God would be that you would ultimately love yourself and you would love your neighbor as well. And they're kind of interconnected. If you don't love yourself and you don't love God, you're not going to love your neighbor. The triangle that it creates is clearly a health question, and I would argue a spiritual formation question. And so you can see evidence of these things in your life in ways that indicate, oh, I probably need to work on this. I need to work. I really don't love my neighbor well. And when I say neighbor, I mean humans. Jesus is really clear. It's the people you encounter in your life. It doesn't matter where they are, where you are. It's not purposefully the person that lives next door to you, although it is the person that lives next door to you. It's just everybody else too. So as you encounter these people, how am I doing at loving them? Do I see them as God sees them? I can honestly say there are times when that is just definitely not true. And that is part of the immaterial work we have to do in how we relate to God, how we relate to ourselves, and then relate to our neighbor. And with that being said, we see that in this they're inseparable. And so our soul is connected to our identity as image bearers. And so as we focus on the soul, we're asking the question, how do I bring life to my soul? How do I work my soul? How do I cultivate my soul so that it has life and that it actually moves me towards loving God? How do I see myself and how do I see others? And so it's rooted in this idea of understanding that we were created as image bearers of God. And we talk about this a lot, and I get that. But it's probably the most forgotten piece of soul work is that the image of God in us ultimately is what gives us great worth. And it is not what we can produce that gives us great worth. It is the image of God in us. And I just want to take you through a couple of verses in Genesis to kind of connect those dots for you. And the first is in Genesis 1:26. He says, "Then God said in the middle of creation, 'Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground.'" It is this moment that we realize that what is stamped on every human is the likeness of God. It is his image in us. And it brings value to all humans, including yourself. And so to understand the image of God becomes that much more important for us to be able to understand how the soul works, because there's a connection between identity and soul that is undeniable. And then in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, another account of the creation, "The Lord God formed the man of dust from the ground." So I don't know if you picture that, how you picture that. "And breathed into his nostrils the breath of life," which is also the soul. So it's more than giving you mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, now you begin to breathe. It is part of God encountering humans in such a way that he breathes life into them. He fosters them with a soul, which is connected to this idea of identity, of having the stamp of life on you. That is created in the image of God. "And the man became a living creature." So grasping this is important. And oftentimes it's just forgotten as we go through life, the busyness of life, and we encounter people, and we encounter all the things that we do. And we find ourselves oftentimes just going through life. And as we go through life, if we're not aware of these truths about who we are, we often drift into how the world defines our worth, which is where I find most of us live. Okay, so I have a quick slide just giving some clarification to what it is the image of God on you and me is. And it's first that we are human beings that have autonomy, meaning he made us in such a way that we have choice. He made us in such a way that there is an awareness of our individuality and an awareness of our connection to him. We are unique in that. And then the second one is we are beings that have moral agency. We can choose right and wrong. We can choose against our instincts. We don't have to merely be driven by our appetites. We have the capacity to choose right and wrong. And that is unique in creation. We are beings that have been tasked with the care of creation. We are in its fullest sense, we have been made in the image of God and inherited the job of tending for what he created. He's basically said, "I made you like me so that you can take care of what I created." So we're tasked with something. And it's not just tasked with, and I think we often think of this in terms of we're tasked with taking care of the planet, like the resources but we're also tasked with each other. Creation, you are created, you're part of creation, and part of what we're tasked with is tending for one another. Love one another. And then the last one is beings that are meant for deep relationship. This is the part that We are so much like God. His intent for us is to experience relationship like he and the Trinity, the three of them together, create relationship. And in that relationship is just this perfect being known and knowing one another. And so you're invited into that. And that is what it means, you know, really quick slice of what it means to have the image of God on you. And you are of incredible value. But don't miss this. The soul is not something that was just breathed into you. The soul is something that is connected to your physical being. A living creature comes from the breathing in of that life. And so it's not just that you have a soul. It's that you are a soul. I know, a simple statement, but profound implications. You have a soul, but you're not just, you just don't have one. You are one. And every person you encounter as you go through your life is a soul. There isn't one that isn't. And so what we talk about when we talk about the soul, we talk about is true of every human, every human. And it is the stamp of God upon that person that gives them incredible worth. And the world we live in is competing for that worth. And the condition of our soul is predicated upon us resting in this idea that my worth is in this undeniable stamp that God has placed on me, not what the world is telling me. And therein lies the discrepancy of the soul work. Because what you hear in the world is going to destroy the soul. And what you hear from God will build the soul. So, how's your soul today? Anybody ask you that? I'm asking, how's your soul today? How's your soul every day? When you wake up, do you know? Are you aware of how you're doing that day? Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever heard the saying, this, whatever this is sucking the life out of me? Well, somebody has. They laughed. My job is sucking the life out of me. The drive to work is sucking the life out of me. Fill in the blank. We live in the world that wants to suck the life out of you. This is the condition of your soul. Because the essence of life is your soul. It's your identity. So somewhere in there, something is happening that either you come encounter with a person and you encounter this person over and over again and you just suck the life out of me. And so our souls have a tendency to get tired. And if your soul is anything like mine, there are days when it's really tired. And then there are days when it's, hey, this isn't so bad. And then there are days when it's alive and it's okay. But let me read from Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30. This is the invitation from Jesus. I love this invitation. He says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I think it's a universal human condition that the soul needs rest. And it's not always what you think it might be that we need rest from. Sometimes it's just, I'm exhausted. I need a break. I need some space. And sometimes it's, I'm just done. But for me, when I hear these words, there's two very distinct ways that my soul gets tired, that my life gets sucked out of me. And I'm going to share them with you in hopes that you will do a little work to ask the question of yourself. What is it in you that causes you to seek some kind of coping with life? For me, the first one is this. When I feel two things, unseen and disrespected, my soul gets burdened. And my natural response to that in my personhood, in my mind, in my head, speaks to me in this way. I've been disrespected and I've been unseen. And my natural response is, I'm going to work harder and so that people will see me and respect me. And so there's a frenetic nature to it for me. I will try to ease the burden of my soul or try to ease the discounting of my soul by doing something that causes and speaks to the symptom in which I've heard and seen, and I've done this perpetually my whole life. And this goes all the way back to my childhood. I just want to be seen and I just want to be respected. And if it's a matter of, and one of the parts of that being disrespected is that I'm not smart. And so what I will do is I will learn and learn and learn as much as I can so that I will get respect. And what I've found over the years of that pattern of my life and that feeling in my soul is that it doesn't matter how much I do, and it doesn't matter how smart I am. There's always someone who can do more, and there's always someone who is smarter. And so it doesn't solve my problem. What it does is it perpetuates the fatigue of my soul. You following me? Okay. Yours might not be that. I hope it's not, because it sucks. The second one for me, there's two very distinct things that go on in me. And this one is might be more common. I don't know if it is or not. I don't take surveys in this regard because I don't want to know. When the world seems so broken and there's nothing I can do, why try? And how this affects my soul is it moves me to a place of apathy. It moves me to a place of hopelessness. It moves me to a place of, this is dumb. What are we doing? How could the world be this big of a mess? And I can take you down a spiral in my head that leads you at a place where you and I are sitting on some park bench eating red licorice for hours. Twizzlers, yes. Just to clarify. It's all right. I'm good. Actually, just about any red, chewy, Swedish fish are right there. What? Cinnamon wrecks it for me. It has to be sweeter. I'm addicted to sweet. Anyway, the stuff that gets stuck to your teeth. So anyway, so yeah. So my apathy turns into eating candy. So those are my two big coping mechanisms in life. And then what I'm trying to do is solve the problem of my soul. Eating candy does nothing for my soul other than distract me and make me feel better for about, I don't know, a few minutes until I realize I've just ate a pound of licorice. And that does something inside of me that's different. But I still feel the same, right? Doesn't fix it. I don't know what your method of dealing with these things is, but we all have some things. And so what I'm looking for is rest for my soul, right? So the invitation of Jesus is, come to me and I will give you rest for your soul. My answer to that question is, I'll eat some licorice and I'll work harder. And it does nothing but make me more fatigued. Because that is the answer that the world has given me to the question that ultimately is only answered in the one that breathed life into me. And so doing soul work is, it starts in this place where you go, huh, I know what I do. I work more, or I study more, or I try hard to fix what's wrong with my soul through means that will never fix what's wrong with my soul. And so I want to ask you another question as I step into the next part of this is, how valuable is your soul? I asked you how your soul was doing, and now I ask you, how valuable is it? How valuable is everybody's soul? How valuable are you? And how do you determine the value of a soul? Apparently, we can sue people and find out the value of a soul. But in Luke chapter 19, verse 10, I think we get a glimpse into the value of a soul. And it's a verse, and it's tacked on to the end of the story of Zacchaeus. Yes, Zacchaeus, the wee little man. And we're not going to sing the song, but we are going to, I know, isn't that sad? He climbed up in the tree. No. So the story of Zacchaeus as a kid was totally missed on me. Other than Jesus went to his house and ate with him. Not knowing the significance of said meal. Not knowing the significance of who he actually was. Zacchaeus was just a wee little man to me when I was a kid. And as I'd grown up and realized, he was the chief sinner in town. He was the traitor in town. He was the chief tax collector. He wasn't even just an ordinary one. He was the chief. And they were a special classification of hated individuals in the Jewish community. And they were not considered to be clean, and they were not considered to be somebody you eat with, and it was not definitely something that God would do for sure, is sit down and eat with one of the great enemies, traitors of all of Israel. But what does Jesus do? He sits down with a soul and has a meal with somebody who didn't deserve it, who was considered to be one of the greatest of trespassers, the one most unworthy of the time of Jesus, let alone most unworthy of God's grace. And he sits and have his meal with him. And this is the phrase at the end of it. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Sign me up. I begin to see the value of the worst of us when I read this. The worst of us. Not the best of us. Not the person that had it all together. Not the person that you would go, yep, that's the guy that Jesus would seek out and have dinner with and say, you are my friend. So I find myself strangely buoyed in my soul by knowing that Jesus ate with Zacchaeus. Next verse is 1 John 3:16. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. Romans 5:8 says, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. There is a value to the human soul that we can't fully grasp, that's willing to go out of its way to redeem, to buy back, to purchase, to find a way to sit at the table with those of us who are the worst of us, even when we are at our worst. So somewhere in the value of the soul is not equated by the way the world equates the value of a soul. God sees past what the world sees and sees you as someone who is created in his image and is of enormous value. Jesus said in Matthew 16:25-26, for whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul, for their life, for their identity, for their core being? What is it worth? It's the worth of God giving his life. That's unfathomable. It's unbelievable, but yet it's still true. It sinks into our fiber if we let it. So what's the value of your soul? What's the value of your neighbor's soul? How do you see yourself in the middle of all of that? Your identity is built into this idea that you were created in God's image. You were created for a purpose. You were created with great value. You were so valuable, he was willing to die for you. And not only that, he extends us the courtesy of inviting us into deep and abiding relationship. And it's not predicated upon whether I'm smart enough. It's not predicated on what I do. It's not predicated on my ability to withstand something or the right prayer or the right. It is predicated upon Jesus coming and dying on a cross and saying, I came to seek and save the lost, and I want relationship with you. And oftentimes we just suppress that, and we've been taught or we've been told in our spiritual formation along the way is that unless we do certain things, God doesn't want relationship with you. And that, my friends, is a flat out lie. And so we live our lives with damaged souls. And we try to relate to God through a damaged soul. It's part of the fall of man. And what is it that has ultimately damaged my soul, your soul, our souls? And the first is this. And the first, I'm going to give you kind of a few. I'm not going to dwell in these. I want your questions, so I'm going to try and leave space for that. But what damages the soul first is condemnation. Self-condemnation and condemnation from the world. There is a degree of condemnation we have all received that has gone not just to our behavior, but to our very core and our identity. It is to attach the words, you are a fill in the blank. It could be you know, you may have lied, so somebody says, you are a liar. You are a crook. You are a cheat. You are a, so something in you, or you are not good enough, whatever it might be, but it's condemnation, and it goes after our very identity as humans. And it crushes the soul. And oftentimes, condemnation is the thing that leads us to go, this is soul-sucking. And so it leads us to a place, condemnation, when we wrestle with condemnation, and the beauty of this is Jesus said, I didn't come into the world to condemn the world. I came to save the world. And oftentimes when we hear and feel and experience the condemnation of our being, our identity, our souls, our response is to find a way to overcome it in such a way that it presents ourselves as worthy of not being condemned. And so we find ways to do that. We work harder. We manipulate the words. We make justifications. We do all kinds of things so we don't feel condemned, rather than finding our way into the presence of the one that says, I will give you rest for your souls. The second one is comparison. Oftentimes, condemnation leads to comparison. And what I mean by that is it does damage to us. And so rather than loving the people around us, we compare ourselves to them. Because we can always find somebody that's not doing quite as well as we are. And it elevates us. Whether we do it subtly or just in our mind or like, okay, I'm not that bad. And so we find a way to diminish other souls at the expense of ours, to build us up. It's comparison. I think our culture is built on it, actually. I think a lot of what we experience in life is comparison. So what grade did you get on that paper? I'm not telling. I am not telling what grade I got on that paper. Because you probably got an A, that's why you're asking, and I got a C, and you can feel better that you did better than I did, and I can feel worse because I didn't do as well. And so you learn it young in school. You know, when did you get picked for the team while you were standing next to the school and they're picking teams for kickball? Last? Well, I got picked second to last. That's better than last. Comparison. And now we put it on steroids for everybody to see. We put it on social media. And so scrolling through social media, it's a constant comparison. I don't get to go there. I haven't been there. Wow, their kids are doing much better than my kids. Da 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 da. And we just, there's this, it's a soul-sucking adventure. And so if you find yourself after scrolling through your Facebook feed, I need a bucket of licorice, you might want to stop. Comparison breeds discontentment and envy in the soul. And the soul craves to be healthy, so it'll seek ways to do away with discontentment and envy in comparison to others. It's really hard to love people that you're envious of. It's really hard to love people when you're constantly discontent. That's a soul problem. And then self-justification, the act of soothing our souls with rationale. Make an excuse for yourself. Speak it in your mind in such a way that it discounts what actually has happened, so you don't feel it as deeply, and just move on. Our souls and our identity are formed around our ability to prop up our soul and prop up our identity by the means by which we have been taught, the default by which our culture leaves us, and it leaves no room for the rest of the soul. Okay, now that I've totally depressed the room and moved you to that place, how does it change? What do I need to do differently? And how does the soul now get life? What gives life to the soul? And you're all going, come on. Rest does. And how do you find rest? You got to find the answer in the way that God deals with us in ways that the world does not. And the first one out of the gate, and I'm going to start here because it's probably the most difficult to understand, is forgiveness. You have been forgiven all your sins by a God who died for you. And he's not looking for your performance. He's looking for a relationship. And yes, there are times when we do things wrong and that we repent and we seek God for forgiveness and we go through that process. And that process isn't as much for God as it is for you and for your soul. Forgiveness is stepping into this. To receive forgiveness is one of the hardest things to do. You want to know why? Because your soul wants to defend whatever you did. And it doesn't want to own whatever it is I did. And we don't believe that actually rest for my soul comes from repentance. Rest for my soul doesn't come from speaking out loud that I offended you or I offended someone. We don't connect those two dots, but it actually does, because it moves us to a place of being able to say, I need forgiveness, I receive forgiveness from God. And to receive forgiveness from God is to release us from having to be perfect in order to be in relationship with God. And if you can release that, then you don't have to work yourself into the good graces of God. And you find yourself living in a space that is very much so, I'm forgiven, and in my forgiveness, I can extend forgiveness to other people, and it's easier for me to love people because I own my own stuff, and they have their own stuff. And I can lean into that relationship much easier, knowing in my soul and in my identity, yeah, I'm not perfect, I do things wrong. I own those things. I go to God. I find release and forgiveness, and my identity is intact and rests in him. It's easier to hear from him, too, when I'm not trying to hide things from him. And the release allows the soul to flourish. And so one of the questions that we all have to wrestle is, what makes it so difficult for me to receive forgiveness? Is it just owning up that I did something wrong? If that's your struggle, He is so safe with all that we've done. He knows anyway. Just bring it. Forgiveness is what gives life to the soul, because you don't have to keep paying over and over and over again to be right with God. It's done. Receive that. And that means, that's a lot of what it means to live in grace. Grace is the next thing that gives life to the soul. What is his expectation of you? What have you come to the conclusion that God expects from you? Jesus says, come to me, all of you who are burdened and weary. Who's he talking to? Who are the burdened and weary? Anybody? All of us. Yeah. Come to me, and I will give you rest for your souls. And in that, he doesn't say, you have to come perfectly, you have to come and say the right words, you have to pray the right prayer. He doesn't say any of those. He says, you come, and your soul will find rest in relationship with him, because he unconditionally accepts you, he unconditionally loves you, he's unconditionally with you. He is the ultimate lover of your soul. He extends mercy. Two things I want to add to that list, and then we're going to go for questions. It's gratitude and kindness. Something happens in us, in our souls, in our inner being, when gratitude is the posture of the soul towards God and towards people. It must be one of the most difficult things on the planet to do, because I lose that sense of gratitude the minute I feel disrespected. Again, it goes back to, now I want it to be right. Or I feel like I'm unseen. Nothing worse for me, and this is a straight out confession of sin here, is sitting in a room, waiting at a table, waiting to be served at a restaurant and being ignored. Something about that goes right to my soul. And I have to manage my emotions, and I have to manage what's going on around me, and I have to manage the voices in my head. Because there's part of me that is like, I want to say something. The reality is, now as I'm sitting in front of you and I'm saying it out loud, like, what is wrong with me? Why can't you be patient? Why can't you just have a little bit of patience? Why can't you see that they're busy? Why can't you see that it's not really about you? They've ignored everybody in the room. But if I can speak it out, I can hear myself, and it's not the voice that's the loudest. And the voice then becomes diminished, and it loses its power as I begin to recognize, oh, crud. I'm not the most important person in this room. That would move me to being a person of patience, kindness, gratitude, and actually say something to the effect of, is there any way I can help you? Rather than, don't you see me? Those are two different things. See, I want to be around people who are very gracious, very full of gratitude, full of kindness. Those are people I want to be around, not the ones that want to condemn me. That's soul-sucking. And so with that, that's soul work, guys. That's what it means to search our souls. I'm going to ask Susie to come up. We're going to try and do a few questions. I'm going to ask the band if they want to come up and be behind us so this goes a little better. But it's actually putting into practice being able to hear Jesus over the noise of everything else. And that requires us actually to do some spiritual formation, and it requires us some time to be able to understand what you're listening for too. So I know that's a lot. I kind of push my chips in and say, is there any questions in the room? Susie's going to help me answer them.
We have one that came, we have a few that came in online.
Okay.
So we can start with that. This is a two-part question. Number one, can you define relationship with God?
Okay.
And
all in 30 seconds.
You want to do that first?
What's the second one?
Could we not use God's forgiveness, in quotes, as an excuse not to repent or make amends with the people your actions have hurt, i.e. a spouse who has had a extramarital affair?
Wow, those are loaded. Okay, relationship with God. How to define that? It is a faith relationship. You step into this relationship as God has extended himself through the person of Jesus. We find ourselves wanting to move past a transactional idea of what a relationship with God would look like. Transactional would be, he died for my sins, I believe in him, and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. Whereas a relationship would be an ongoing conversation throughout life that draws us into being more like the person that Jesus is. So it's a transforming relationship that requires work on our behalf. It's not one-sided. He's working in us through the Spirit. It's not one-sided. He has given us the Word. He's given us people. And all of that to cultivate within us this idea of moving more and more into the likeness of Jesus. Mm-hmm.
I would add intentionality.
Yeah.
And I would also add that relationship changes over time.
For sure.
Like all of our relationships do. They grow.
Right.
They grow deeper. Mm-hmm. They sometimes grow apart. They,
yep.
You know, the way we relate to each other changes.
Like, yeah.
I think it's really helpful to look at it like that.
And it's acquiring the skill to listen and sit and mm-hmm. listen and hear
yeah.
from him. Yeah. And then the second one was about forgiving a spouse that has done something.
Well, just forgiveness in general. Like, can you like take the fact that, well, God forgives me, and then use that kind of as a way out of making amends
yeah,
with anybody that's hurt you.
You can do that, but that's not what forgiveness is. Forgiveness, let me just define forgiveness a little bit. Forgiveness is agreeing mm-hmm. To not hold the consequences of your sin against that you've done. So the consequences of your sin affect me, whatever that is. And then forgiveness is me saying, I'm not going to hold those consequences against you. It's not a one-time event, and for the life of us, we do not possess the capacity to forget. We remember.
Yeah.
And so each time that consequence comes up for me, forgiveness is to say, I chose forgiveness, so I'm going to continue to forgive. So there's a ongoing relationship with forgiveness in all relationships, mm-hmm. not just big things or little things. So that is the essence of the soul, is to be able to say, look, everybody does stuff that affects me, and I'm gonna forgive, but I'm not gonna hold the consequences of their sin in my life against them anymore. So I'm gonna move back into the relationship. Now, there are moments when people do what they're saying is, I'm just gonna keep sinning against you because you are a person that will just put up with it for the rest of your life. So at some point you come to a place where you go, yeah, I forgave. I'm going to live with the consequences in my life, but I'm no longer going to allow them the ability to keep doing it to me. We often call that boundaries. But you don't have to be in the relationship in such a way that a person is allowed to keep hurting you over and over and over again. So that's what I would say. And we can make the excuse, God forgave me, you have to forgive me. Without owning it, and without, I think restitution is part of it. Part of true forgiveness is that something I did cost somebody something else, so I should enter into some form of restitution. Because then we're really owning it, and it actually frees the soul. It frees us from having to ongoingly make excuses for what we did. We can just say, yep, I own it, I did it, I repent, I seek your forgiveness, here's the restitution, let's move forward. And I'll do it. I'll try not to do it again.
But there's a whole, like, there's a lot of pieces involved in what you just said.
Yeah,
and
that
a lot
was
of processes.
A very
like there's I forgive you, and then there's will you forgive me? And mm-hmm. there's, you know, that takes two mm-hmm. things. And
yep.
then there's a difference between restitution and forgiveness, and
yeah.
making amends and forgiveness, and
yep.
restoration and forgiveness.
Yeah.
Like all those things.
Things are a thing, and
yeah.
that's like a series.
Yeah.
But there's you can't make somebody forgive you.
Mm-mm.
God does forgive you.
Right. Was there a question? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tim.
So I see a lot of my soul value just from the message today based off of what I can accomplish in my work, whether or not like I did the job to the best of my ability in a timely manner.
Yep.
And how do I shift that view into God's view when the world pushes me to stay on the accomplishment value?
That's the work. That's the perfect question. That's the question that it sits in everybody who gets their worth by what they do. Like, I'm with you. This is the ongoing challenge, right? So what I end up doing is recognize when I'm doing it. Okay, so when I'm doing it, I've learned to speak it out loud. Okay, my soul so desperately wants to be affirmed for what I just did. And why? Because I want to be seen. Well, I want that to be the feeding my soul. The question then for me that comes into play is, does God see me? Is he with me? Does he see what I did? Does it matter to him? Yeah, I think it matters to him that I did a good job. It matters to him that I've done what I said I would do. But does he love me more because I did that? Is my worth? No, right. And so it's a ongoing battle of that's what the world tells you you're worth, and this is what God tells you you're worth. And I move mostly into this camp as I've gotten older, but I still wrestle with this because it's part of being human, and it's seeking something so desperately that I want. So it's not easy, but it's the work. And part of it is quieting the mind a little bit, and we'll talk about that next week. It's quieting the mind a little bit and being able to hear more from God than from the world. But the world is so loud, so loud.
Can you just also really clarify what you mean by the world when you say that?
The world has a set of values that they've determined what the soul is worth. And that, from culture to culture, is different. The United States is pretty obvious. What can you do? What can you accomplish? How do you look? There is a clear value that is spoken to us from the time you do well in sports, do well in school, do well in whatever, and you will be valued. So value, that's what I mean, is it screams at us, and that's been taught to us. And so we've now assumed the value of our soul is predicated on that. And God has said something totally different, and it wars against that. And he won't force himself, that voice, that little voice on you, where the world is saying, yep, this is where you live. And I'm going to suck the life out of you because it will never satisfy. Never. It'll never find rest for your soul in it. I've tried.
Do you have another one? Okay. Oh.
We
yes.
got
one more.
Nick after.
Long time listener, first time caller. I really appreciate what you said about gratitude and kindness replacing particularly comparison, struggling with that. And
yeah.
In my own journey, I've just been fascinated how quickly I can lose my joy over comparison.
Yeah.
And I feel like 2 or 3 years ago, I had a breakthrough of going, my issue is not with the people I'm comparing myself with. It's
That's right.
So much more gross and sinful and dark. I'm actually disappointed in God that he gave somebody the favor or the opportunity or whatever.
Right.
It gets so much carnal and just to be aware of that. It's not my issue with these people.
Right.
And so when you talked about viewing others as image bearers of God, it was really helpful. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Nick. No, that's all right. There's one over here. And then we probably need to put a bow on it.
Okay, so from the beginning when you were talking about the image bearer and just coming from Southern Baptist evangelical.
I'm sorry.
My
yes.
question is, like, was there a point in history where theologians took things that were taught a certain way and shifted it so that it was, obviously we can sit here and hear and reorientate ourselves to scriptures in a different way.
Sure.
But why, do you know why or when it came about, you know, we're only chosen if we choose? Like, oh, the Baptists are chosen. We mm-hmm. need to go
oh, right.
try yeah. to get other people chosen versus you're born with this identity.
When did it shift?
Was there like a shift? And is it cultural? Is it like...
There's,
like the scripture's always
there's a whole,
been,
yeah,
but
there's
why,
a whole lot
why
of people,
was it taught that way?
Right, there's a whole lot of people that would disagree with me on this position. So that's, okay. first of all, that's...
Well, there's a whole spectrum of belief on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's called Reformed theology that moves into predetermining who's in and who's out. And the really choice doesn't matter. Free will becomes a non-issue. And so I think part of the image of God in us is free will, is the capacity in us that makes us like him, not him, but like him, is to be able to choose, is to step into those things. So it changed when people figured out they could control people that way. And I think that goes way back.
It's just opposite ends of saying you're chosen, you're valuable, you're worthy, identify this way, versus you're broken, you're sinful, you need to do something.
Right. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so the polarization of those two things being...
Like, it's the same scriptures.
Yeah.
But it's being...
Taught.
You're asking why are some people teaching it this way,
yeah.
and why are some people teaching it this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I said it at the beginning, you know, we're all learning together. I've studied both sides of that. I've come to the conclusion that I land somewhere in the middle of, I think both of those truths of being chosen and choosing are true. Mm-hmm. I think they're both true because they're both in the Bible. And I don't know what to do with it. It's a paradox. Yeah, Tim.
I feel like a lot of the ways that we see and interpret things as an adult is based on the mindsets, frameworks, wirings, whatever that we picked up as kids.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So as people that I know have older kids, do you guys have any advice for those of us that have younger kids on ways that we can go ahead and plant a seed of this kingdom worth mentality mm-hmm. versus a world society worth mentality?
Yeah. Go ahead, Susie.
I think that, again, this is another thing that people might disagree on for sure. But I think, like, I know your kids are really little. And I think when kids are little and they are not, they're not able to think in a nuanced way. They don't see gray. They only see black and white. I think we do kids a great disservice of teaching them about God in really black and white ways. And this is, I'm speaking out of my regret here. So let me just be really clear about that. So I think when kids are little, the thing that they need to just have infused in them over and over again is how fearfully and wonderfully they're made, how much God loves them, how magnificent God is, how beautiful Jesus is, all the wonderful ways that he chose to live out the person of God in the flesh, why he did those things, and how his spirit, through his spirit, he's present with us now, what he's like with us now. Like, those are just the things that little kids need to hear. As they get older, we can talk about things like the cross in more detail. We can talk about salvation in ways that they may be able to understand. But I mean, like, you know, we're standing up here saying we don't fully get it either. So why would we expect a 5-year-old to understand predestination and total depravity. I mean, all those things, right? So it's, I just think that we do kids a really big disservice when we try to give them these big lofty concepts that half of us in this room are trying to figure out. And they just really need to know how beautiful Jesus is and how much he's with them and loves them. Does that help? And I think, Kim, going back to your question, because that's a struggle that I have too, and I agree with Kevin. I think both of those are really true. And the honest thing that I think is, like, it really just depends on the context in which you grow up in and the type of teaching that's been given to you. Like, I think people tend to lean on one way or the other because it connects with us in a certain way, right?
Yeah, it's cleaner.
Yeah. And so we're always looking for the way out, or we're looking for the answer to the question. And depending on where you find the answer to your question, it's usually in, you know, this kind of a spectrum. But I think the thing that we need to remember is that when the scripture talks about being chosen, he's talking about, in my opinion, God chooses all of us. But whether we choose him or not is a whole different situation. And we also have to remember that Genesis was written, it begins with chapter 1 and not chapter 3. It begins with, it is good. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of times we want to start the story in chapter 3, and that's not how it's given to us. So there is a lot of balance there, and there's a lot of wrestling there. And I think it's really good to look at both things and prayerfully engage God with these questions together. I mean, that's why we do this, right? Does that help a little bit?
Can you give a practical example of what it looks like to get rest from God? I have never experienced that, even though I've heard it my whole life.
You want me to go or you go?
Well, you can go first.
rock, paper, scissors.
I mean, you were the one talking, so she probably wants to hear, or he probably wants to hear from you.
Sure. Rest for my soul is the invitation into the relationship in such a way that it moves me away from conditional acceptance. And so let's say I gave a couple examples where I get really agitated, where I feel like I'm disrespected, or I'm somehow, some way, unseen. And so my response to God is, see me. And I make demands. And so rest for my soul is first a recognizing that my soul has been agitated, where somewhere in me is the need to fix this, because I can't rest in it. And it moves me to do things that are unhealthy. I work. And so as I recognize now those things in me, I sit and I listen for the voice of God. Really hard to do, because the other voices of my struggle are really loud. And God's is usually the quietest. So it's a discipline to sit and listen for the voice of Jesus. And the voice of Jesus says something to the effect to me, and he says, I'm with you. And knowing he's with me helps me. Knowing he's with me and he loves me the way I am. I don't have to prove anything to him. I don't have to prove that I'm smart or worthy of being seen. And so, because he always sees me, he's always with me. But when I get disconnected from God is generally, I don't believe that's true, or I forget that it's true, or the other voices are winning. And so I have to move myself to a place where I can be quiet and hear the voice of Jesus. If I can't hear the voice of Jesus because the other voices are so loud, I never find rest for my soul. My soul will always be agitated.
You asked us this question before we started the gathering in the mm-hmm. context of forgiveness.
Right.
How do you know when you've been forgiven? So that's kind of like a rest for your soul type
right.
question.
Yep.
And for me, when I'm not at rest with my soul, I hear the voice of shame speaks in the language of regret to me. So I think about all the things I regret, and I kind of stay in that place. But when I have when I'm experiencing rest for my soul, I'm able to hold those regrets right next to the way those regrets have been restored, and I can celebrate and walk and enjoy the process of restoration that's happened in that. I think sometimes for me, I'm looking for rest for my soul to feel like some kind of mental, emotional, spiritual version of a good night's sleep. And that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes it's like, oh, this is really, really hard, but okay, I'm thinking about all these things that I did that caused this situation to be what it is, mm-hmm. and yet look at what God has done in spite of myself, mm-hmm. and look at what God has done, and he's taken this thing and made it this thing, which it would never be had it not been for this thing, right. and I can kind of walk in that tension. Mm-hmm. That brings me rest to my soul. So.
The other thing that happens is we'll do something wrong, like I'll be angry and hurt somebody. And so part of the unrest of the soul is wrestling with my own guilt and my own sin is, and then part of the process of rest for the soul is to come to Jesus. You find yourself in a place of confession. You find yourself in a place of, please forgive me. And then also, because this isn't just isolated to my soul, it's also somebody else's soul, because I've done damage to somebody else's soul. So I go back and I say, look, I was wrong. Please forgive me. Now, then it becomes a will question for them, but that also brings rest to the souls, because I've owned my part. I've owned it in a way that is sincere, and is there anything I can do to bring rest mm-hmm. to your soul? Because I think we do bring rest to each other's souls.
Well, yeah, that's part of tending to your soul so that you can see others.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
Are there any questions in the room? Yes.
Tim?
Brooke?
Good morning.
Good morning.
So my question is about the connection between emotional numbing and the soul and the damage emotional numbing does to the soul. So let me be a little more specific what I mean by emotional numbing. So I think we all, or many of us, have developed like this coping mechanism of dealing with our emotions that comes from having grown up in a way where we never really learned healthy ways to manage our emotions. So for me, that comes in the form of like, it's very difficult for me to sit with uncomfortable emotions because I don't know how to sit in the pain. So instead, I do a lot of things to distract from that. I like to run, I like to eat, I like to listen to music, and all of those are good things, but they can become harmful when coupled with what I am trying to use them to do.
Yes.
And other people have different emotional numbing techniques like drugs and substance abuse.
Yep.
But I think that is the great American epidemic right now, is emotional numbing.
Yeah.
And it's something I've been working very hard to just sit in my discomfort and my pain mm-hmm. and my struggle. So my question is, if there are other people who are experiencing this and just trying to learn how to sit with difficult emotions, mm-hmm. how can we do that in a practical way that helps to heal our soul?
Good question. This is how it works for me. I don't know if it works for everybody. Is there's a recognition. I don't always recognize it right away. Like I'm like, hey, I could really enjoy 5 pounds of Twizzlers right now, right? And halfway through eating, you know, pound one, I go, oh wait, I'm doing something. And so the recognition has become quicker for me rather than after 5 pounds. I'm now in the middle of, okay, I recognize that I'm now numbing my soul, and I ask the question, why? What am I doing? What happened? What did I do or what happened? So that's the first part of it, is just the recognition why I'm doing what I'm doing. And then the second part of it, I think, is understanding that the light shined on whatever it is most important to me, okay? So what I mean by that is I speak it out loud. And if I can, I speak it out loud to a person. I speak out what it is that's going on inside of me so I can hear it. Oftentimes when I leave it in my mind, when I leave it in here, and I never speak it out loud, it doesn't make full sense in there until I hear it and somebody else hears it. So to sit with Susie
also loses its power.
Right. You bring it in the light. And then it's easier to go, oh, that sounds really dumb now. Or that was my inner critic telling me something that I believed a long time ago that I don't believe anymore. But I believe, you know, in the moment, I'm like, I don't know what to do with this. So I eat or I do whatever. And so to shine light on it exposes it for what it is and allows me to be able to deal with my soul rather than just numb it. Does that help?
It does. And I also just wanted to add what you were saying earlier about in those moments of discomfort and sitting with kind of pain and having just the awareness of like, not God, I demand your presence here to fix this, but hey, God, I really need you to sit with me in this and just like be here with me.
Yep.
That is very healing to me, I've found.
Yeah. And his voice is usually the quietest one. Yeah. And so I have to focus on the quietest one. Yeah. It's a good question.
First, I just wanted to say thank you to both of you just for your vulnerability, like with the teaching last week and this week, just being able to share those. Sorry, Alina. Just share your examples, just what I hope it is.
How jacked up we are.
Thanks, Susie.
It makes you feel not alone. And
right.
But it's just very valuable. I just so appreciate that. So I guess my question is, how do you help someone in that place when you kind of recognize that they might be going through something like that, like stuck in a spiral or whatever? Mm-hmm. You know, it's so difficult to approach someone because then sometimes it comes across like you're just judging me or whatever it is. How do you speak into someone when you feel like they're trapped in that diminishing spot?
Yeah, I think you wait to be invited. Otherwise, it's really difficult. Mm-hmm. But you be present, even in their trap. You speak to them as they let you. Also, I've said to a few people, I said that I knew were kind of in that spiral. I said, I know you haven't invited me in, but I do know that if you speak it out and wrestle with it in the light, it will free you.
So it's okay to judge them until that point. I'm just saying.
Yes.
Okay, great. No.
No, it's not.
No, I'm joking. I'm joking. But no, that's great.
Well, just as long as you don't condemn them, I mean.
Yeah,
hey.
Yeah. No, I get you.
No, what was your next? Did you have a follow-up?
No, not really.
But okay. You know who's like the kind of people that are, this is why like I love spiritual direction. Mm-hmm. And there are people, I mean, you can go to a spiritual director for spiritual direction, which is awesome. But then like for me, like the best of friends are those who know how to spiritually direct me in those situations. Because you can't ever do somebody's work for them. And you are not the rescuer. But what spiritual direction offers us is a person who can shine the light and kind of like help you connect with God to find your way through, you know. So I think often we, especially if it's somebody like our kids or something like that, or someone we feel responsible for, we feel like we need to fix it for them and do it for them. And that's a really easy trap to fall into, especially if you've had more life experience, you know. But that's not the way. So, yeah.
Yeah, wait for an invitation. This is where also, you know, sitting down with a pastor, sitting down with Sam or Susie and having a conversation about what is going on in your mind is really good, or a therapist.
Yeah.
This is where speaking it out becomes more than just shining light on it. It becomes, oh, okay, I can hear from somebody who's actually can possibly help me and see what's going on. We need to wrap this up.
Okay, so Jean has a question, but while Sam's walking to her, can you talk about the difference between heart and soul? I think that's good to connect the 2 weeks so far.
Okay. In the Bible, it's hard to pull apart the immaterial. You're made up of material and you're made up of immaterial, and we're doing it almost we're trying to identify certain parts of us that are all part of our immaterial self. And so we've said, let's just talk about it from the vantage point of the heart. When we talked about the heart, when you talked about the heart last week, it was about the house where we house our emotions. It's the we live out of the overflow of our heart. Our soul is more our identity. It's who we are deep down inside. It's who we wrestle with, who we are. And so those are probably the two differences that I would. And then we will ask.
Just a brief
expansion
on rest. When I was in college, my mother had a nervous breakdown, and it was chaos, and I was questioning God. Good Catholic girls, like
Catholic girl.
Oh, you boy. Know, I've done all my Hail Marys and Our Fathers and all that, but I didn't understand. But you know, campus ministry was kind of tweaking my brain, right? But that whole idea of rest and growing up your whole life being the mom, mm-hmm. and away at college and the guilt and everything, but it's like Psalm 23, you know, how do I just rest? And it told me, and I realized now throughout my life, I need all my senses engaged in a very trusting way. He leads me to green pastures. He sends me to still waters. If you've never laid in a green pasture, you got to do that.
Well, and
you
it know. Also says he makes me lie down in well, green pastures.
Well, but
so
he does.
Resist that
but it starts off.
Restores my soul.
Yeah, I mean, but it starts off with him being the shepherd. So, I mean, mm-hmm. I couldn't trust my dad because he was PTSD after World War II. My mom was losing influence because she lost her mind. And I was the oldest of four kids. You know, and God had his hand on us, no doubt, over the years. But that actually getting in that space or using those sensory clues, being outside, laying down in grass, listening to the wind, hearing the brook, all that God has created, that interface between our heart and soul and mind, we've got a large physical component mm-hmm. that we don't tell just be still because he invited me and he trusts me and he's going to guide me and then guides my interactions. So anyway, sensory works, you know, it really helps.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
There are other questions.
The
band is invited to come back up. There are other questions on the text line. If you text it in, we will respond to you mm-hmm. throughout the week. And Sam is going to be in the lounge at the 11 if anybody wants to talk further. And also, just so you all know, when we put the podcast up now on midweek, I think it goes up on Mondays, we actually post the questions from both gatherings because they're all so good and so different. Mm-hmm. So.
And we further discussed this on Journey on My Mind. If you haven't found that podcast, I encourage you to find that. Thanks, Susie, for helping me have the band come up. I just a couple of things just as we go into our time around the stations. And the thing that I want you to hear is Jesus says something different than the world says. He says, come to me and rest. There's always time to do work. He says, come to me and rest. He says, come to me. It doesn't matter how much you know. Your competency is in him. And he says, come to me, I love you with all your shortcomings. And so as you go to the stations this morning, this afternoon, I just want to tell you, practice taking communion with this in mind. It should remind you of the value of your soul and all the other souls. He died for us. When you write out a prayer, ask God to let you feel the depth of his forgiveness and his grace. And ask yourself, what makes it so difficult to receive these gifts? And then the third one is fight against the way the world determines value. Be generous. Give. Sing as though no one else is listening. I know for me that's like, ooh. Let your soul free to sing the praises of your God. Because no one's judging you. Let them know how you feel. They're going to just play a little music here for a couple minutes. You can walk around the room, write a prayer, remember the worth of your soul, do some soul work.